Hello, I'm Niall Kahn, and this is the PPRO Podcast. Every other week, I sit down with James Booth to discuss the latest innovations, investments, and acquisitions that have taken place over the last weeks. James is off gallivanting this week from meeting to meeting, and so I am joined by Matt Jackson, partner manager at PPRO, to discuss the last couple of weeks' news. Matt, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Pleased to cover for James. I'm not sure he'd agree that he's gallivanting, but he's certainly not here.
All right. Let's kick off with the last couple weeks of news. So it's almost Halloween, and if you don't have a costume, you could probably get by with trying to dress up like Libra, which at the beginning of the week looked like a corpse, and now it looks like it's rising from the dead. Matt, can you walk me through the week of news with Libra?
Yeah, for sure. So it's a very strange one with Libra, and I think it's probably in a phase that most startups will go through, but we just hear more about it because it's effectively sponsored by Facebook and had some very large investors. So I think when the news broke a number of months ago, it spoke about the Libra network and who was going to be involved in that. Companies like Visa, MasterCard, Stripe, real sort of behemoths of the finance industry. And I think they were due to have their first meeting last Monday as the Libra network and elect their board members. In the days preceding that, Visa, MasterCard, Stripe pulled out, and I believe there was another company who pulled out hours before that meeting. What that doesn't mean is that the project's dead in the water. I think it still has some momentum, and so from what I understand, the meeting happened. Five board members were elected to continue the journey towards their end goal. And ever since then, some other companies have come on board. So it seems like it's in a lot of flux. I think the major players have been spooked by the regulators' reaction to this. There's been a lot of reticence from some of the regulators about the concept itself, how it's set up, Facebook's involvement. And I think companies like Visa, MasterCard, Stripe have taken the view that perhaps they can better spend their time and energy focusing on other projects that maybe aren't so controversial.
Matt, I was just going to add that the one payments company that you forgot to list off there was eBay. And so that only leaves one payments company still in the Libra group, and that would be PayU, which is a Dutch-based PSP. All the other brands in the Libra Association are now mostly consumer-oriented. So you still have Spotify in there, and I believe Uber as well.
Yes, and I think when you think of what Libra could be, it will live or die by how many consumers it can get on board. So perhaps it's almost inevitable that you need these consumer brands leading the way and driving innovation to find use cases that support consumers more than outside of just payments.
You mentioned that they're going to be onboarding a lot of new partners. How many new partners are they talking about onboarding?
So the Libra Association is claiming, and obviously there's no way of checking this, but there's 1,500 organizations that are expressing interest, and probably about 10% of those, around 180, meet the criteria for membership. My early view when the news came out about Libra initially was that the criteria for membership of the association was somewhat prohibitive. It seemed it was designed to get these big behemoths on board. With them falling away, does that mean they're going to relax the membership criteria and perhaps allow some smaller niche players to come in? It'd be interesting to see how that develops over the coming period, and they will need to take into account regulators' views on how they develop that strategy.
It doesn't look like they're going to be relaxing those market requirements. It says that the new partners will have to hit two of three thresholds. They'll have to either have a $1 billion market value or $500 million in customer balances, reaching 20 million people a year, or be recognized as a top 100 industry leader. That sounds almost like they're opening it up wider if it's a top 100 industry leader rather than the brands we saw like MasterCard and Visa.
Yeah, and I think that's what I meant about relaxing the entry criteria, making it more achievable for a lot of companies to take part in the association.
Excellent. Well, and to round out all the bad news for Libra this week, it seems as though they might have borrowed, stolen a logo from a mobile banking app called Current. It turns out that both logos were designed by the same firm.
Yeah, I mean, how liable Libra are within this from a sort of actually operational point of view, I don't know. If you outsource to a company, you're expecting them to make sure that they don't copy a logo that they've already done in the past. So, while it's always hard to be sympathetic to Facebook's causes a lot of the time, I don't think they can carry too much guilt with this one.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to Malaysia, Matt, where Malaysia is going to be introducing a new scheme to get people on e-wallets. Just for a little bit of background, we have some figures on the Malaysian e-commerce market and payment scheme split there. In Malaysia, the e-commerce growth is looking at 38.9%. And in the entire APAC region, the average is 22%. And the 38% figure is actually the highest in the APAC region. And if we look really briefly at the e-wallets there, Malaysia has a relatively low usage of e-wallets compared to the regional average. So Malaysia has, at the moment, 6.4% usage for e-commerce transactions, and the regional average is 46%.
Yet an important market in Asia Pacific, not only from an e-wallet perspective, but you see the stats around the growth of the e-commerce market. I think it means there's a lot of opportunity for other payment methods to crop up. I think the spread of e-wallets in that region will mean that the focus from Malaysian authorities on encouraging that use is probably a wise one. They've got a really interesting way they're doing that, so that I think they're offering all of their citizens aged over 18 and below a certain wage threshold, $7 to fund an e-wallet. It doesn't seem like a lot in the Western world, but that, you know, could be quite significant in Malaysia. And who's going to turn down free money? It seems the only requirement is to open the wallet, claim the money and use it within 2 months. And so if you can get a wallet that's got a fantastic customer experience, it seems like a really good user acquisition strategy from both the wallet and the Malaysian authorities who want to encourage the use of the wallet.
Okay, so I have done some math, and it looks as though the threshold for people getting this will be up to almost $24,000. So it's pretty wide open, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
It's they're trying to get a huge chunk of the population.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, based on your maths now, I think we did some other maths, and that could benefit about 15 million Malaysian citizens. If you got a 10% conversion just from this one marketing initiative, 1.5 million active users of your wallet, you'd definitely see that as money well spent, I think.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, actually. And what's interesting is you also see other countries trying to get their populations to switch to e-wallets. India kind of tried to do this disastrously when they got rid of like their most popular currency. Mm. This immediately backfired. But this seems like a fairly good idea, you know, bribe the population to join.
Yeah, I think India was a different use case in that they were trying to, it was maybe less about encouraging use of e-wallets for financial inclusion. And it was a way of trying to stop black market money becoming the dominant use case for cash in India. But it'll be interesting to see, knowing the consumer behavior in that region favors e-wallets, it would make sense that we'd see Malaysia shift towards that. Be interesting to see the stats of how that changes over the coming year.
All right, from Malaysia, let's turn our attention now to India, where SoftBank has invested into PayTM. Matt, can you tell us a little bit about PayTM?
Yeah, it's very, very significant in the India market. Took some investment last year from Warren Buffett, valuing the company at about $12 billion. This investment, only a year later, would value them at $15 billion, which as a return on investment, I don't think anybody would be upset with. Yeah, so I think they talk about the money they raised being used to fend off some rivals coming up in the market, people like Google, Amazon, and BHIM, the Indian bank's e-wallet. Yeah, India as a market is very interesting. I think we're going to see more solutions popping up there, maybe some consolidation, maybe increased competition. Just by sheer population size, it's going to be significant. And when you consider that e-commerce is growing at 27%, there's a significant opportunity for anyone who can gain a foothold in that market.
Yeah, and SoftBank isn't the only person investing in Paytm at the moment. It's also Ant, which is the parent company of Alibaba and also the parent company of Alipay. So this is another chance for them to try to stick their leg into one of the most massive markets in the world.
Yeah, and it seems very sensible if you're Ant Financial and you're in two of the most significant markets already, why not push for the other third by population size?
Yeah, so Ant has had a fairly busy week this week. Besides investing in Paytm, they've also struck up a partnership with a Russian firm.
Yeah. And I think this is probably as a result of geopolitical macro global scale forces at play. Russia is a very interesting market for a number of reasons, but it's quite hard for Western companies, especially Western companies that have ties or business interests in America. It's sometimes very difficult for them to do business there. So it seems sensible that a move from the East by Ant is a way of leveraging access to that market.
What's also interesting here is that this is Alipay's first venture outside of Asia. We talked a little bit about their work in India. They're also heavily investing in a lot of places in Southeast Asia. So the firm that Alipay will be cooperating with is called Mail.ru, and it's one of Russia's leading internet companies. It's like Facebook or Google, and they'll be working together to make e-wallets and to work on online payments.
Yeah, I think all the while it's going to be harder for other countries and companies within those countries to do business with Russia. It creates opportunities for more favourable to Russian political jurisdictions to move in and develop a foothold there. And I think this is Ant's first move in doing that.
Yeah, very interesting. We'll have to see if they can then work their way to expand to the EU, which is where our next story takes place.
So after a long period of delay with banks and third-party payment providers almost at war, the key part of PSD2, strong customer authentication, can now be delayed until the 31st of December next year. When I think of strong customer authentication as a consumer, obviously I'm in the fintech industry and I had to be aware of it, but as a consumer, when I talk to my wife and my mother and my friends, they weren't aware of it. And I think that was always going to be a challenge around how payment providers and e-commerce sites and banks were going to roll this out and make sure that you didn't see a big drop-off in conversion.
Yeah, really interesting. Can you remind the one listener who's not in the fintech industry what exactly the SCA is?
Yeah, so strong customer authentication is effectively another way of making sure that when you try to initiate a payment that it's you. So there are various methods companies can use to do that. The one that seems to have been adopted most frequently is sending you a code to your mobile phone. So as part of the checkout flow, you'll enter your payment details, you'll click pay, and then another code is sent to your mobile, which you then have to enter. It's another way of making sure that you are who you say you are and that you have the right to execute that payment.
Okay, and so what's the reason behind the delay then?
So my view would be that the biggest cause of the delay is providers and banks not being ready to roll this out. And I feel the biggest part of that rollout is the consumer education piece. So technically, you could have always found a way. If you needed to do something that quickly, all of these parties have got smart technical guys that could find a way. They were experimenting with ways to try and make it as frictionless as possible. And I think they forgot to focus on making sure that consumers were aware of exactly what that was. So I will expect over the next 18 months to see a huge marketing push and an education piece from regulators, banks, third-party payment providers in bringing the consumers on board and understanding what's going on.
Just to understand if I'm understanding this correctly, some banks have already introduced this, correct?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, for instance, knowing I've had to enter strong customer authentication details on maybe two or three transactions this week, it is being rolled out. But I think to have that hard regulation that it must have been rolled out and companies would be liable to punishment if it wasn't rolled out, I think that's been relaxed a little.
All right. And Matt, for our next story, if I were to write a tabloid headline, it would be Apple Pay, rotten to the core. Can you tell me what's going on there?
So on iOS, you can only use Apple Pay with the near field communication functionality on an iPhone, and the EU is looking at that from a competition point of view. It's gone out and asked some market participants for feedback on the concerns, which if you're in that market and you're not allowed to use the NFC functionality on the iPhone, I think you'd be raising that as a concern. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops over the next few months and whether that means you start seeing other apps able to tap into that functionality. There's certain payment methods where I think that would be an excellent use case.
Yeah, and NFC is basically the standard for POS systems, right? So if you have your debit or credit card that's NFC enabled, you tap it and go. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same principle in your phone. And if you compare Apple to Android in this case, there are many different Android wallets which are able to use NFC, which allows for a wider marketplace, which essentially Apple has shut out.
Yeah, for sure. That's exactly right.
All right, so let's turn attention now to North America, where PayPal's Venmo now has its own credit card. This is coming on the heels of Samsung Pay and Apple Pay adding a credit card to their service. In my mind, this seems kind of counterintuitive. It seems like a de-evolution from e-wallets and digital payments. You don't see Swish doing something like this, which is a well-known European brand. You don't see Alipay doing this. Why is this only happening in the US?
Well, I think this speaks to the dominance of credit and debit card in that market. And the UK is another market where alternatives to credit and debit cards, local payment methods, are struggling to gain traction because of many reasons. A long history of established banking infrastructure. There's not been a real need for innovative payment methods up until now. So I'd agree that it does seem like a de-evolution. Perhaps, again, it's a user acquisition strategy that if you can get a really good credit debit card experience, tie them into a Venmo wallet, that they then start to use more of that functionality. Maybe it's a way in for them to, at some point, eventually phase those out and convert them into Venmo-only users. But I think it's a way of capturing some part of that credit and debit card dominance market.
I think your point about the credit card being so dominant in the U.S. is really, really good, because according to people's own data, 59% of e-commerce in the U.S. is through a credit card or a debit card. And in Europe, it's 43%. And you're absolutely spot on with the U.K. being as high as it is. I believe it's 54 or 56% of e-commerce transactions are with a credit card, which is, again, much higher than the rest of Western Europe.
Yeah, and in the U.K., I'd be interested to see what the other percentage is for PayPal, which actually is probably just and access to your credit and debit card made easier. I think if you group those together, it'd be even higher.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining me this week. I really appreciate your time.
No worries. Enjoyed it. Let's hope James is back next week from his gallivants.
Well, if not, I hope you'll join us.
For sure.
Thanks for listening to the P-Pro Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to subscribe on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you hear podcasts, and leave a review. If you'd like to follow P-Pro on social media, you can follow them at P-Pro_payments. This podcast only sounds good because of Andre Ratke. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.